Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network's Middle East Studies podcast. I'm Ruben Silverman, a researcher at Stockholm University's Institute for Turkish Studies, and with me today is Alexander Christie Miller. From 2010 to 2017, Alexander Christie Miller worked as a journalist in Turkey, writing for the Times of London, as well as Newsweek, The Atlantic, Der Spiegel, and The White Review. His new book, To the City, Life and Death Along the Ancient Walls of Istanbul, has just been published by William Collins, and we'll be talking about it today. So the first thing I'd like to talk about with you is a little bit about your background. What drew you to becoming a journalist in Turkey? And how did you end up in Istanbul in particular? What was that experience like, especially during the 2010s?
I became a journalist. I was working in the UK on a local newspaper, and I was also doing sort of research on the foreign desk at the Times of London, and I kind of went to Istanbul sort of on a whim. Really, it was I'd listened to a radio show at work, and you switch in halfway through a radio show, and you don't know what they're talking about. You know, they were describing a neighborhood in a city, and the music and the nightlife and the food and that sort of thing. And I'd been thinking that I wanted to go abroad and get into foreign correspondence. And I listened, I was like, where's this place? It sounds amazing. And then, you know, at the end they repeated the name of the city and they said, yeah, it's Istanbul. And so I was like, right, maybe I should think about going there. And it seemed like a good place in terms of somewhere that was sort of on the side of lots of interesting places, but not so central that it had its own, that newspapers had their own bureaus and salaried correspondents and stuff. And when I talked to the Times, they said that their person there happened to be leaving. And so if I went there, then I could pitch stories to them and they would give me a chance. So I slightly went there on a wing and a prayer and without a lot of prior knowledge about Turkey, really. And I sort of did a lot of fevered reading and talking to people and trying to learn the language and stuff before I went there. But it was quite a sort of chance thing in a way. In terms of being in Turkey during the 2010, so I arrived in 2010, and it was a very interesting time to come to Turkey because there was still at this time this narrative which was quite dominant that Erdogan and the AKP were this positive democratizing force, and that the direction of travel of Turkey was generally pretty positive. You know, there was obviously that was far from a universal view within Turkey, but very much within the sort of foreign analyst and journalist community, people who were sort of naysayers of Erdogan were quite often seen as kind of cranks or people who are anti-Muslim or who had sort of gone native with the Kemalists and stuff like that. And it really, you know, I think really 2010 was the last time when it was sort of feasible to kind of have that narrative. And I remember it was the year I arrived. It was Turkey was the European capital of culture. And there was this sense that it was like, you know, embracing the East and embracing the West, and it could have everything. And you know, and what was happening was a sort of normalization from this sort of oppressive past. You know, it was really when you drilled down into the details of what was happening, it didn't really stand up. And I did a lot of reporting in my first couple of years on the Ergenekon and Balyoz cases. And particularly with the Balyoz case, you didn't need to know a huge amount about Turkey to be able to see that this was obviously a fraudulent case, and that large parts of the evidence were fake, and that, you know, people were being framed. So this narrative sort of started to fall apart, and then the events over the next few years, you saw this process in which a lot of the achievements of the AKP in their early years began to unravel, And obviously, we know what's happened since then, and the direction of travel has turned out to be very bad. But witnessing that process was very interesting, and you know, upsetting as well. But
well, indeed. So what I want to maybe think about then is this book, you focus particularly on the old city walls, but maybe you can tell a little bit about how that fits into your in your time as a journalist. So how did you come up with your stories? How did you go about your research? And then how did that lead you to come to focus, for this book at least, on the old city walls?
So I came to the walls. I mean, initially, I walked along the walls in 2012 with a couple of friends, just for fun. You know, it's about takes probably about 6 or 7 hours to walk the length of the walls, I'd say. And I remembered them as this very atmospheric and interesting place to visit. It was a few years later when I went back to one of the neighborhoods along the walls for a story, and they struck me as this very, you know, this incredibly interesting and atmospheric place that I didn't really know exactly what I was wanting to do when I set out with the book. In a way, I think I envisioned what I was doing as almost counter to what I'd been doing as a journalist, in the sense that when you're writing news articles, you come up with your own idea, or, you know, you sort of read what other people are saying about what the big issues of the time are. And, you know, a lot of the stuff you write is reacting to hard news and just, you know, events. But then when you do more analytical pieces, you go and you search for people who seem to illustrate whatever topic it is you're writing about, and then you proceed on that basis. I wanted to do something that was kind of the opposite of that, and I wanted to go to this place and say, right, this is an interesting place, and this is a place which I felt like there were a lot of different threads there which I could pull on and which would make an interesting story. There are lots of different kinds of communities living on the walls. They're facing all kinds of different pressures and struggles. It's a place that has this extraordinary history. And so I thought, I'm just going to go there and I'm going to start talking to people, and I'm going to start researching their history. And I'm just going to see what emerges from that, and see what kind of story comes out of it. So, you know, it's an incredibly inefficient way to go about a project, but I sort of felt like it was might be more worthwhile ultimately than going with a thesis of a point I wanted to make about Turkey, and then try to build that, if you see what I mean. One of the things that I started to find is that the longer I lived in Turkey, the more I became almost mistrustful of my own perspective on stuff. And I sort of thought, in England, I would be far more reticent to pronounce on political events and social trends and different, you know, sections of society and their relationships to one another. And it's only, I think, through a certain kind of, you know, you have a certain sort of insouciance as a foreigner in a country that makes you feel you can kind of analyze them, and you're slightly insulated from what's going on to some degree. And so I sort of wanted to try and get away from that and sort of let people tell their stories and then see what emerged from it.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, one of the things I liked about the book was the way you did use people's stories to come at topics. So some familiar topics were presented in a new way. One that comes to mind is the issue of the Bostans, these gardens along the wall, which were a big deal in the media several years back, because they were being removed as part of these urban renewal projects. And you do talk about them in the book, and you talk about similarly other major topics from the past decade. But because you're focusing on people's lives, you present more of a multifaceted picture of any of these events, whether it's the Bostans, urban renewal, or other things as well.
Yeah, of course. I think I wrote about the Bostans at some point, and certainly during my research for the book, I spent a few days working on a Bostan with one of the Bostanjas. And I think when I started, I probably thought they would feature more. I mean, they do. I mean, you know, I describe early on in the book what one of the interviewees was talking to me about when the boss stands at Ivan Sarai were demolished, and how you know the diggers came and scraped them away, and then everyone picked through and took all the last vegetables out of the dirt that was still left there. You know, obviously they are in the book, but you know, I'd often find that these issues, which are very much in the news, are actually quite peripheral to people's day-to-day lives. And I didn't want to in any way diminish their importance or, you know, suggest they were trivial. But particularly, I'd say, like, the urban renewal issue is one which is often feels like in Istanbul is kind of worrying about it is the preserve of a certain kind of, I don't know, like sort of middle-class section of society, possibly. This sense sometimes that... you know, these activists swoop into a neighborhood and but then when you talk to the people there, they're often more ambivalent about what's happening. And they have all kinds of other worries. I wanted to have those issues there and readers can be aware of them and see that they're going on, but also keep people's lives and the sort of more immediate concerns of their lives kind of front and center, if you see what I mean.
One thing you do in the book is you do weave in these current stories you're telling with historical accounts of the walls, of the conquest of Istanbul by Mehmet II. And in doing that, I'm wondering how you were thinking about this as you were writing. How do you see the connection between the past and the present? Is it a matter of the past is affecting the present, or is it contrasting with the present, or is it more an issue of, even in the poetic sense of echoing with present events? How do you think about that?
My thoughts about it was very much, I think, more along the lines of that I'm trying to create an impression rather than trying to draw too literal a connection of cause and effect or contrast with the present. It sort of goes back to what drew me to the walls, because, you know, when I was living in Istanbul, you had this sense of these sort of, you had these literal monuments littered around the city, which often felt quite disconnected from the present day life. I mean, you know, obviously you have the history of the Byzantine past and that whole culture is so completely vanished. And yet you have these monuments left behind. It made me think of a description from that I read during my research from the time shortly before the conquest of the city by Mehmet, when Constantinople was very dilapidated. And one of the travelers who went there said that, you know, people no longer knew what the inscriptions meant on the buildings. And they had they ascribed these superstitious beliefs to these buildings, which you know, had quite other messages when they were built. And that struck me as being in some ways similar to now. You have these people carrying on with their lives with this history around them, which is quite disconnected. And yet looms incredibly powerfully in the background in terms of the current political discourse and the way in which the siege is seen as this foundational sort of defining event in the sort of Turkish national character. I wanted to convey something like that I thought by juxtaposing this story from the past with people's present lives, I wanted to create that feeling of the past kind of looming. And, you know, you can't say categorically what its significance is and what its connection is, but it's there, which is, you know, a feeling that you have it that I think you have in Istanbul. To me, there were lots of interesting resonances between the siege, which is, you know, the main historical story that I tell in the book alongside the present day, and the present, in terms of within the story of the siege, you have encapsulated this force of technological and cultural, you know, sweeping technological and cultural change. You know, Mehmet brought modern cannon technology and highly organized and efficient state to bear against this structure which had been built a millennium earlier as this sort of bulwark against all these forces which wanted to, you know, which threatened to overtake the city. So it's sort of, it's a clash between innovation and the sort of preservation of the past. And you know, you see that thematically played out today in Turkey. And also there's this sense of surrounding the siege of almost apocalypse on the behalf of the Byzantines, who in their own religious views, they saw the Byzantine Empire, or the, you know, Roman Empire as it was, as the sort of the empire of God, and that its destruction would mark the end of the world, and you know, the coming of doomsday. And so in our own time, potentially catastrophic forces facing us now have this same sort of slightly apocalyptic feeling about them sometimes. And so telling the story of people who were sort of living through that in the past, and then juxtaposing that with the present, when there's a similar sense of stuff looming over, but to the lives of the people in the city, they're sort of similarly remote or peripheral in some ways. That's, I think, now with retrospect, that's to me what the interest of the siege boils down to. But the actual process by which I arrived at that was sort of more organic, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, one thing you say is the presence in the city of these large past monuments, but another aspect of the book, and just an aspect of daily life in Istanbul, is the sort of present day large urban renewal mega projects. And I'm wondering if we can talk about those a little bit too. So are there any of these big mega projects that you think are particularly representative of policies in recent decades in Istanbul, and maybe some examples from your book that show how there's many different ways people react to these large projects?
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, I think that the one to me, which is most iconic, is the new airport. And it's certainly the one which, in my time as a journalist, I had the closest, you know, involvement with writing about and that sort of thing. I mean, on the one hand, the story of its construction and the awarding of the contract for its construction to this consortium illustrates the way in which the AKP has used this effectively network of patronage and corruption in the awarding of construction tenders as a way of cementing its power. So the consortium which built the airport allegedly was given the airport as a kind of quid pro quo for also buying a struggling media network, which Erdogan was worried would fall into foreign hands or, you know, end up being owned by someone who he couldn't control. You know, it's a very strong and clear example of the way in which, you know, they leveraged their development agenda as a way of reinforcing their increasingly authoritarian control. So, you know, the airport was interesting in that sense. And then purely in an environmental sense, like I remember visiting the site where the new airport would be built before construction started. And it's an enormous, enormous site. You know, it's something like 20,000 acres. And I remember going with a guy and he pointed out, yeah, so that it starts here and it's going to end over there. And it was this point on the horizon. And, you know, you could say it wasn't exactly virgin woodland. You know, it was there was some sort of old mining sites and there were lakes, but it was very much a greenfield area, and there were woods and there were lakes and there were fields, and it seemed almost inconceivable to me then that this whole area would be leveled and turned into runways. And yet it was. And, you know, there were very strong arguments for saying that they could have built the airport in other places. They could have expanded existing capacity at the other airports, that there were other things they could have done rather than completely building over this piece of land. And the reasons for them doing so tie into the sort of ancillary construction opportunities that it would open up by building in this sort of relatively untouched area. And then also just the kind of symbolism of it and the importance attached to the prestige that attaches throughout Turkish Republican history to building sort of big projects. And then finally, you know, the last part of your question, in terms of the reactions to it, I found the airport particularly interesting for that reason as well, because, you know, I remember when it was built, I sort of felt kind of enraged. And I was like, God, I don't want to go there. And I was sure I wouldn't like it. But then I've flown into it many times now, and I've just kind of, in spite of myself, I just sort of accepted as the airport, and a lot of people seem to like it. And it sort of illustrates the way in which something that seems monstrous and awful and terrible when it first happens, you become kind of acclimatized to it, and it becomes kind of normal. And you sort of, you know, people forget that this used to be virgin land. or you know, relatively unspoiled land. So yeah, so that was, to me, was probably the most iconic of the mega projects which were taking place in the city when I was there.
Yeah. Well, let's then turn from these big mega project stories to the more intimate scale stories, because that's what you do in the book. You move back between the large scale and the intimate. So in the book, you're introducing a number of different people who live and work in the neighborhoods along the walls. Perhaps you can pick one or two of these and discuss them a bit. How did you meet them and interview them? To what extent do you see their lives as purely individual stories versus being representative of these larger processes of the AKP, mega projects, large events? How do you see that connection?
I spoke to lots of different people, and I sort of deliberately didn't want to try and tailor too much the people I spoke to around what I thought the issues were. But, you know, obviously I did to some degree, but, you know, I was like, I don't want it to be just men, or I don't want it to be people from just this background and that sort of thing. I tried to make the book somewhat representative as far as I could realistically do within the neighborhoods around the walls, if you see what I mean. But I very much, you know, I spoke to a lot of people whose stories I didn't end up including. The people who I spent the most time with and who I followed most closely tended to be people who I felt were honest, weren't trying to manipulate me, didn't have some kind of agenda that they were trying to get across, and people who had a sort of story that they wanted to tell. And I kind of allowed myself to be led slightly by that. One of the individuals who I'd focus on is Kader, who when I first met him, he was a AK party activist. He had a very interesting kind of journey through the book, because when I first met him, he told me how, you know, he had this very sad story about his mother, who had a spinal injury and was languishing in hospital for years without getting any proper treatment. And this was in the pre-AKP era. And the AKP came to power, and they reformed the hospitals, and his mother began to get better treatment, and he felt that they'd made such a sort of tangible impact on his life that he became an activist and got involved with the party. And I remember him telling me that the head of the SESEK, which was the social insurance organization that ran a lot of the public hospitals, that was Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who was then the leader of the opposition. And so for him, it was sort of corruption and the inefficiency of the old system was kind of demonstrated by the guy now leading the opposition. And over the course of the book, he very much fell out of love with the AKP, and in fact ended up voting for Kılıçdaroğlu in the most recent election. And it's funny, because in a way his story is quite counterintuitive. I mean, if Erdogan had lost that election, then maybe I'd be saying, well, his story is very illustrative of, you know, the way things are going. But I guess I say that to make the larger point that I'm quite skeptical of the idea that people's stories are representative of social trends. I mean, obviously they are, but they're also confounding of them at the same time. And I wanted to kind of like, I wanted to show that, but in terms of something that arose out of all the stories together, which I think touches most clearly on the sort of core themes, or one of the core themes of the book, which is really the sort of, you know, the decline, the rise of authoritarianism in Erdogan's Turkey. So, you know, Kader, when I'm talking to him about why he's changed his views and stuff, you know, he's from Kahramanmaraş, which was one of the epicenter of the terrible earthquakes last year, and he lost many, many family members. And you know, he was saying how he was going there, and he was trying to say to his family, like, look, you know, you shouldn't be voting for them. They're not going to do anything for you. But in his telling, effectively, people were so desperate, were so needed something to cling to and to hope for, that the government, by making promises and promising they would do this stuff, so it's almost like the way he described it almost seemed like gamblers who were just going for one last bet. Like they couldn't quite believe that they would let them down, or at least, you know, that there was no one else conceivable who seemed to offer any kind of alternative salvation. And that kind of narrative tied in with the stories of other people I spoke to. In particular, you know, a couple of the people who are more sort of anti-AKP activists. You know, I had one guy who I talked to a lot, Farhat, who was a you know, communist activist, and then also I spoke to a you know, HDP Kurdish activist. And they respectively, like, well, the Kurdish guy actually ended up fleeing Turkey and traveling to the US. And Farhat, the communist guy, ended up kind of ducking out of politics. And he had a kid and he was like, I need to think about my family. And, you know, I've sort of learned to be silent. So I it wasn't something I, you know, I thought when I started following these people, I didn't know how their stories would end. But there was very much a convergence in terms of, you know, the people who were against the government kind of learnt to become silent very often. And then also through this slightly sort of charity-based model of activism that the AKP has, and this sort of charity-based model of social outreach, they're able to present themselves as the salvation for the problems which they themselves are causing. And as people become poorer and more desperate, they also become, and this is the point that you know, one of the people I spoke to, or a couple of the people I spoke to, made, is that as people become poorer and more desperate, that charity-based model of social activism only becomes stronger in a sense. So yeah, so the stories converge to illustrate that what sort of underpins the success of Erdogan's authoritarianism. But on the other hand, if he'd lost that election, which he could quite, you know, he came quite close to doing, then what would I be saying then? I don't know.
Yeah, no, then all these stories could be stitched. Someone could stitch all these stories together and just like justify a very different narrative.
Well, that's the difficult thing, is that I was writing the book for a very long time, and so I was sort of conscious of the fact that I didn't want to write something that depended too much on any one political moment. And I wanted it to be ambivalent, you know, because you know, I feel ambivalent. I don't know what I think all the time about what's going on in Turkey, and I wanted to sort of, I wanted it to be quite open in that sense. So, you know, I don't know if it's how well it's worked. I hope it has, but that's what I wanted to try and do anyway.
Yeah, no, I agree, because for example, I think in your account of like the Gezi Park protests, for example, you do a very good job of capturing both the excitement, enthusiasm, but also you talk to people who have exactly that sort of feeling of uncertainty about what these protests represent, or what the people who are leading the protests represent, as some of the interviewees you have. So I think you give a good sense of the ambiguity in a lot of these moments.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I wanted to do, and particularly with the Gezi element, was that I wanted to be sort of slightly upfront about my own views as well. Because I sort of think that, like, it was, for me, Gezi was a moment where I personally felt very inspired and supportive of what I saw happening in Taksim. And it was, to me, it was, you know, it seemed like this sort of extraordinary coming together of different sections of society. And there was a lot of potential for positive change embodied in that. I wanted to kind of, and, you know, I make it clear when I'm writing at Gezi that that's how I felt about it. And that's how I feel about it. So I sort of tried to be, where appropriate, I tried to be kind of upfront about my own prejudices in that sense, my own. And also it's difficult because you're trying to balance, one of the other dilemmas I found is that I was trying to balance being fair to all the different sections of society represented in the book, whilst not minimizing the ongoing suffering which Erdogan's authoritarianism is inflicting on a large portion of society, and sort of relativizing that, or, you know, minimizing that. So that was a kind of a dilemma that I was battling with while I was writing the book.
Well, all that said, you know, one of the more striking for me parts of the book was the way you talk about some of these, again, along the walls now I'm talking here, some of these neighborhoods being, I guess, hollowed out, losing their character. You describe, for example, this kind of, I guess, an old men's cafe, if you will, that it still has its customers, but now they come from hours away to get there, for example, you know, and the characters that used to inhabit the neighborhoods have kind of gone away, the street toughs and these kind of flamboyant characters of the past. And it stuck with me, and it made me It made me just wonder this sort of larger question about what changes you have seen in your time, both in your time there as a journalist and coming back in the years since. How have you seen changes occur? How have you understood them? How have you thought about a lot of the changes you've witnessed?
I don't know. I mean, it's been a time of, massive change. Obviously, like one of the difficult things I found writing the book was that quite soon after I started researching and interviewing, actually for sort of personal family reasons and, various reasons, we moved back to the UK. And so I find it very hard to disentangle the question of how Istanbul changed from the question of how my relationship to it changed, because I found when I was living there, the processes of change seem very kind of, some street is changed and knocked about one week and then another street is knocked about another week. A sort of beloved cafe or row of shops is pulled down and then something else is put there. And this kind of goes on and on. And then when I moved away, it both seemed like the changes, the sort of physical changes to the urban landscape came to seem more dramatic and more wrenching. But then also you go other places and you'd be like, well, it's exactly the same as it was before. And I think, the most dramatic change that I've witnessed over my time there is in the political landscape and the social landscape, in the sense of, people becoming more scared. That's very real. And the nature of public debate, particularly after the coup attempt in 2016, the nature of public debate becoming far more constricted, that's kind of extraordinary. I remember the first time when the state and various institutions began putting up billboards, cursing traitors and talking about the homeland, remaining united and all that sort of stuff. And that to me seemed incredibly weird at the time. And now it's just sort of come normal. But on the other hand, because I no longer live in Istanbul and I haven't for a long time, I feel to a certain extent distant, and that I'm sure there are all kinds of more subtle changes which are passing me by. But my focus remained very much on that one little area. Going back to your question about the neighborhoods emptying out and communities hollowing out, that was something that a lot of people talked about. People would always talk about how the sense of neighborhood closeness and the sense of community was less than it was in the past. Partly I wonder if that's not just what people always say as they get older, and that community always kind of, falling away. But on the other hand, I think that the sort of forces of social change, technological innovation, and then these urban development projects and this sort of stuff, I do think that there is some fraying in the bonds of community which is happening at the moment in Turkey as a result of all these things. And I think that it's a process which is much further along somewhere like England than it is in Istanbul. Like when I first moved to Istanbul, I was struck by how the streets seemed a lot safer than they were in London. I felt safer in Istanbul than I did in London. And when I looked at the crime statistics, for most kinds of street crime, Istanbul is was at that time among the safer cities in Europe, and that was very interesting to me. And I think to some degree that's to do with the fact that neighborhoods were these strong units that sort of controlled their streets, and if there were sort of tearaway kids, everyone would know who their parents were, and communities were far more present and powerful organism than they are in England. I have the impression that that's becoming less and less the case. And, I think particularly if you go to some of one of the neighborhoods I talk about far away from the walls is Esenyurt, where you have very large immigrant communities who have been uprooted, who have often suffered you know, trauma from where they've come from, and who are now in this very sort of high-rise environment, and you have some massive social problems going on there. And I think that's a process which is advancing all the time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. And I mean, in those cases where there's less of a social safety net, there's many problems, but there's also probably the same social disintegration in the high-rise, nice high-rise apartments in somewhere like Ataşehir, on the these big, you know, very, what can we say, bourgeois housing projects. Yeah.
Exactly. And the thing is that that's how people want to live. You know, that's how a lot of people want to live. I mean, so, you know, some people don't, but I mean, it's obviously a model of living which is attractive to many people. Yeah, it was interesting to me how many people I'd come across who were I mean, I tended to focus on the people who had stayed behind in these neighborhoods, who were by definition people who didn't want to live like that, but they were often the minority. There were these new apartments, they had better central heating, they were more convenient in various ways. Often they weren't, because they would be built and then there wouldn't be, the apartments were built and occupied before all the kind of, you know, municipal and social amenities were in place. And so then they were very inconvenient places to live. But then gradually those would come, and then, you know, they would become a fairly nice place to live. But there is this sort of atomization of community that comes about as a result of that, and is reinforced also, I think, by the way in which people consume social media and, you know, all that sort of stuff, which is also going on.
Yeah, well, I mean, to bring it full circle, it may be the project of the AKP to bring this kind of society and economy to Turkey, but it's not uniquely the AKP.
No.
So it's good to focus the story as you do on individual people and how they're affected by it, rather than making it a larger story about, oh, what Erdogan is up to, what the AKP are up to, but instead showing individual people's lives and the effects on them.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, they are like the AKP are a part of a much bigger process, a sort of economic model which embraces the whole world, really, or most of the world. And, you know, also forces which are sort of beyond their control in terms of, you know, economic and technological forces that are beyond their control. What was interesting to me mainly about their role in it is how, as a socially conservative party, they've been very successful at both riding those forces, and they've been the willing midwife for this process, and at the same time have benefited from the disruption that it's caused, which always sort of struck me as interesting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to conclude, I've intentionally tried to skip a lot of the amazing examples in the book, because the book covers, you know, things from these urban renewal projects we're talking about, and from the larger historical reverberations. But you also have environmental pollution, discussions of things like the coup attempt in 2016, dog rehabilitation centers, drug addiction rehabilitation centers. You cover so many things and you tie them to people's lives, which makes it really, again, a nice book to read in that regard. So I hope people will go out and find it and read it. And let me ask you two things, really. One, this book is, right now, you were telling me, only available to people in England, but it's going to be out soon in America. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. So it's currently, it's, you know, it was released last week or the week before last in the UK, and it is going to be published in the US in October. So yeah. So you know.
Okay.
I would urge everyone to go out and buy it.
Yeah, no, I would too. And the last thing we always ask on these podcasts is just what you're working on now. Is, are you mainly working on getting this book out, or do you have new projects you're looking at as well?
I'm sort of torn between several new projects, and a couple of them are so completely different that they're not even relevant enough to mention. But I have an idea to. I think my next book won't be about Turkey. I want to sort of have a different kind of relationship with Turkey for a bit. And, you know, I have a Turkish family and I go back often, but I would be interested to, you know, one of the things I said earlier was about how I would never feel confident enough to opine on my own country in the way that I was often invited to, you know, give this kind of, you know, you, as a foreign correspondent, you're called on to give kind of authoritative sounding analyses of what's going on. And I thought about how uncomfortable I'd feel about doing that in my own country. And then, so I thought I would quite like to do something which builds on the interviewing techniques and the kind of method that I've developed doing this book, and to do something about my own country. And I think possibly I'd be interested in writing about the town where I worked as a local journalist, because, you know, that was a time when the British newspaper culture is a very kind of morally murky and sort of sometimes exploitative and sort of slightly dishonest world. And I was sort of thrust into that when I was working on the local paper. It was only a small local paper, but it had a rival in the same town. And there was very much this kind of, it modeled itself on the British newspaper, The Sun, you know, the British tabloid. And so it was a very interesting time. And so I'd like to write something about the town where I was working. I think, you know, in a way it feels like it'd be more scary, because in one way it's easier because, you know, they're obviously, it's going to be easier to meet and get to know people and hang out with people and stuff. But I would sort of slightly have to grapple with my own place in my society and that sort of thing. And so something about that, you know, that's what I'm looking at anyway.
I mean, I think that would be a very interesting book, as for all the reasons you're saying. I mean, it's not that what you're writing about with Turkey, and your book on Turkey is very humanist in a sense, right? So taking that perspective and bringing it to another setting would make perfect sense.
Yeah, it would be. I feel like I'd be building on something I've already done, and the only drawback is that whereas, you know, the walls of Istanbul have a kind of more immediately interesting than a small town in southern England, which is not very well known.
Well, perhaps, you know, just hanging outside the Greggs and interviewing people as they
yeah, exactly, pass by. Exactly. No, I used to get my lunch at Greggs every day, which was a big yeah.
Well, there you go. Well, okay. Well, look, thank you very much for talking about the book. And again, I think people will really enjoy it. So if they can find it, read it, I think they'll take pleasure in it.
Thanks very much. It's been an absolute pleasure to be on here.